Hi, this is Jordan Lund, Deputy Sheriff from Fletch Lives. And after I arrest someone for molesting a dead horse, I like to relax back at the station with an episode of Laker Jim's Fletchcast.
Broadcasting live, and around the world, from Cabana One, the only podcast that's all ball bearings, your ultimate source for everything Fletch.
Moon River.
Whew. Thank you, Doc. You ever serve time?
Laker Jim and his beat reporters will stop at nothing to make sure Fletch lives forever.
Forever.
They don't shower much. This is Fletchcast.
Thank you, Sammy, and welcome everybody to Fletchcast. I'm your host, Laker Jim. Joining me as always, my co-host, two men who multiply by masturbation, Jake and Big Bob. Boys,
it's not that uncommon to find actors, cast, who are willing to talk about the original Fletch. Little mini documentary on one of the DVDs, but rarely do Fletch fans have the opportunity to hear from anyone connected to Fletch Lives. But that's exactly the opportunity we have today. Joining us on the show, the Deputy Sheriff of Thibodeau, Billy Bob himself, Jordan Lund. Jordan, welcome to Fletchcast.
Thanks a lot, Laker Jim. Nice to be here.
You know, Fletch Lives is one of those movies that I think got panned early on and over time has become a little more respected by fans.
By fans, maybe.
For me, this is special because everybody that listens to our podcast knows that I hold Fletch Lives just as high as I hold Fletch. So this is a big deal for me. I love the movie. And despite how it may have aged, I think it's a fantastic movie.
Well, you listen, I was actually just watching it just now. Before I got on with you guys, I was watching and I stopped it. And the scene I stopped it at was just after Chevy grabs Julianne and pulls her into the shower, takes the towel and throws it over and says, yeah, we need a new one. This one's too wet. The scene just prior to that, when they're sitting on the bed just before he goes into the shower and she's just come out of the shower and they kiss. That's like a really creepy kiss for a family comedy because they both went in like with open mouths. And that was got to be all Chevy because he was, you know, I believe a bit of a horn dog. So.
You better get cleaned up.
Yeah, particularly my mind.
I don't know. I didn't know him personally. I don't know him personally. I can't speak to any of his actual personal behavior, but it certainly came through in all of his improvising. So listen, I think it's a... It's got some funny stuff in it. It's got some goofy stuff. I was also, just before I was looking at it, I was reading some things like about Gregory MacDonald, trying to remind myself of the books. And I read all of the books, all the Fletch books. And it's been a long time. I think I gave away a garage full of books about 10 years ago, and that was among them. And I couldn't remember any of them, but then again, I'm 65, so that's a normal thing to happen.
Now, was this prior to working on the movie?
Yeah, I was a fan before I ever got an opportunity to audition. I was a big mystery and detective fiction fan, and I was particularly attracted to what they call the gifted amateur. And that's who Fletch is, someone who's not a cop. Who's not a detective, because I didn't really like reading cop or procedural stuff or detective stuff. I liked reading about someone like Fletch. And so I was like that. And so I liked Gregory MacDonald. And also, Gregory MacDonald had a cynical edge that I always liked in those books. You know, he had a sense of, you know, a kind of a skewed vision of the world. And I want to say that I think that the difference between those books and Chevy Chase in the movies is his cynicism is more sarcasm, and it's a little strident sometimes, his sarcasm, but that was his shtick. That was always Chevy's shtick. It's his shtick at Saturday Night Live. It was his shtick for Kentucky Fried Movie and all the other, even the rom-coms that he made. There was always still some kind of wise ass you know, sarcasm that, you know, was part of it. Right. And it fit Fletch to a certain degree.
Amazing to hear that you are a fan of the books. But what bad luck that you get the one movie that's not based on a Fletch book.
When was that? I was 88. So I was 31 years old. When I grew up, I used to imagine what it would be like to work in the New York theater in the 1930s and to be an actor on stage in London, whatever. But I never dreamed about being an actor in movies or TV. It was never an option. I never even considered it. I was doing Shakespeare on Broadway in 1987. I turned 30 that year, and I thought, what the hell? Maybe I should consider doing this thing other than this thing that I've been concentrating on for all these years. And I had an agent that I started working with that year who suggested I move out to LA. And I thought, as soon as I get a few jobs here in New York, and I did, I moved out. So I always thought of LA and the movie and TV business as just a good way to make some money if I was lucky enough to get the jobs. And I was. I've been taking my pension from SAG for 10 years now. It was a good way to make some money. But I didn't early on have a lot of respect for the medium of movies. So the idea that they would, cobble together a movie based on a character in a book that I respected meant nothing. It was because movies were, it was just fun. Everybody's having a good time.
Was Fletch Lives your first film?
No, it was one of them. They all happened in the same year. Jackknife Fletch Lives, Lock Up with Sylvester Stallone. We shot some of that in New Jersey at Rahway Prison and of it in New York. It was funny, on Lock Up, Sylvester Stallone had seen it, when we were shooting Lock Up. I'm trying to guess if he had seen an advance thing, but he used to give me shit on the movie about being that deputy sheriff and, you were in that Funny Farm movie or whatever that was with the Chevy Chase,
That's a great impression.
I heard him a lot. I worked on that movie for 4 months. That was one of those things. That was also during the writer's strike, where most of that movie got written by Stallone. After the first day of shooting, they gave us something like 35 pages. And as you probably know, one page equals usually 1 minute of screen time. So that wasn't a full-length movie. And we just kept getting new pages every day. And they were mostly written by Stallone. Sometimes we got handwritten pages that his assistants would make copies of to give us. And I got lucky with that one because he liked the fact that I was kind of a dick in that movie and he wanted me to get my comeuppance. So I ended up shooting more and more scenes just because Stallone wanted to, make me to be a really bad guy. And then when we finally shot our final scene, which was my final scene, big fight scene then, we spent 5 days working on that and they were, arguing, do we kill him? I think we have to kill him. He's such an asshole. or do we just, put him out of his misery for a little while? So that was kind of fun.
It's too funny.
Yeah. So it was one of the first. So I had not done much stuff on screen and I was just watching myself in that Billy Gene King Bug Busters scene, looking at myself. Boy, I did not have a lot of skill as a film actor, and I've taught film acting for a number of years, and I would not want to show that scene and say, this is an example of how you do it.
Well, if you can't see it, how do you know you got one?
Well, I'm glad I asked that question.
We're a little naive to the process of movie making. How much did the writer's strike impact the production of not having the writer on the set? How did that affect the movie?
I listened to the other two podcasts and you talked about Leon Capitanos and, he had established himself pretty well as a screenwriter at that point. He was kind of he and Paul Mazursky teamed up and they did three pretty big hits together. Moon Over Parador with Richard Dreyfuss and also again with Richard Dreyfuss Down and Out in Beverly Hills and Moscow on the Hudson with Robin Williams. So he wrote all three of those before Fletch Lives. So the version that we got from him was solid, but it wasn't Chevy Chase solid. It was different than that. I was just reading about Capitanos because after Fletch Lives, that was his last movie. He stuck around in Hollywood for a few more years, but didn't write anything else. And he has a degree in poetry. And he's written, I don't know, about 10 novels since then. And he lives in North Carolina, where he's from. And his work was always intelligent, politically savvy, funny, but not funny like goofball funny. So it had to be tailored for Chevy, and it would have been tailored, because most sets, what ends up happening is you get rewrites. I mean, what'll happen is somebody will write the script. Then they maybe attach a star to it. Then the star wants to craft the script in their own way. So they fire that first writer and hire another writer, or maybe it's a team of writers this time. Like, you've heard the names Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel. You've probably seen their credits many times.
City Slickers and things like that. Yeah.
And they've written a ton of stuff, and they'll be the next team that'll come in, and then they'll get fired and they'll put in another team to make some other changes. By the time you get into production, you're going to be getting pages on a daily basis. With Fletch Lives, there may have been some new pages, but it was mostly improvised. Most of everything that was done was improvised. And Chevy is just a master. I mean, his skills as an improviser was just unparalleled. He would come up with some stuff. Okay, so that name, Billie Jean King Bug Busters.
Oh, Mr. King, I don't know nothing about no Bug Busters.
I wish I could remember, but I'm 65 and, you know, probably... over the years, I've smoked too much dope and drunk too much whiskey to remember the details.
Nothing wrong with that.
but he went through about five or six different names as we rehearsed it that he would come up with. And the scenes, like the line, the reticularius Mario Cuomo.
What's what?
Reticularius.
So you can't even say it yourself.
That was about the fifth or the sixth choice. After trying a bunch of different ones, we shot that scene at Silver Cup Studios in Queens. And what had happened was I was in New York and I was cast in the movie. And the first scenes I had to do were in Los Angeles at Universal Studios. And those were the scenes in the jail and the scenes where we arrested him in the apartment, in the house. With Hal Holbrook and Randall Tex Cobb.
Take your pants off.
He really is a great guy. I mean, he was then. As a matter of fact, I remember we were both staying at the Sheraton Universal Hotel, which is right there next to Universal Studios, and they were picking us up in a van to take us into the studio for us to, you know, work together. And they pick us up at the hotel, and he's got a handful of books with him. And I look at the spines of his books, and one's like a physics book and one is like a history of something. And I mean, like a really, really smart guy who was really interested in learning stuff and just knew some shit. I mean, he had that look at his face, you know, that brow that made him look like a Neanderthal, but he, you know, and he did take some punches in his life, but he was a really smart guy. He knew how to play that character. Anyway, so we shot that stuff at Universal, and then I went to work at Silver Cup, and I don't know what they didn't use from the Universal shots, the things in the jail and the arrest, but I kind of manhandle them a little bit. I throw them into the cell bars and then throw them into the room and say this shit like, you know, you smell good too. You'd be popular around here or whatever I said.
You smell nice.
That was improvised, by the way. And they said, oh, we gotta get a little revenge. We gotta get a little revenge. So they decided to pump up that scene, with the Bug Buster scene a little bit. So they did. And then they watched that and they thought, oh, that's good, but he's not humiliated enough. And they actually, I was very lucky because of this, financially, it was very fortunate, because they decided, oh, we'll bring him down to Gonzales, Louisiana, where they were shooting all the, you know, the stuff down there, the exterior plantation stuff, and come up with a gag. And the gag is not really in the movie. I mean, it's the costume party scene where everybody's dressed, and I was dressed in like a Confederate general outfit with my wife, who was a local extra that they put on the horse and buggy with me. And the gag was obviously the caddy with no brakes would bang into the back of the buggy, and as I was opening the door for her, it would knock me over. And what is not shown in the movie and what was shot is it knocks me over into a fountain.
Oh my God.
That's right there in the driveway. And the fountain, in the middle of the fountain, is a statue. And it's a statue that's a replica of the Belgian statue of the pissing boy, the pissing cherub. And so I would land in the fountain and have my face pissed on in fairly close up by the little pissing boy. But they decided to leave that out. They thought that was going a little bit too far.
But you did shoot it.
Well, we shot it. I was disappointed that it didn't get in, but it would have been fun. But in any case, that added to my money also, because it was one of those days that goes on forever. As you might imagine, it's a plantation that they're renting out in Gonzales, Louisiana. I don't know what month it was when it happened. I can't remember. I could go back and look, but it was about 98 degrees and the humidity was about 103. Without raining. I mean, it gets nasty, like living in pea soup down in, Louisiana. and I was lucky. I had a little half a trailer that I got to be in, and it was air conditioned. And I didn't have to put on my wardrobe, which was a heavy wool Confederate uniform, until just before, my scene. So I just hung out. I had a couple of books with me. I had my Walkman at the time, my music, and I smoked cigarettes. So it ended up being about a 23-hour day, and I just stayed there forever and ever. Ran out of batteries, had to go get batteries from the prop department. Ran out of cigarettes, had to get cigarettes from the prop department. Had nothing else to read. Started wandering around the set and meeting people, but it was too hot. And then finally, I got to go and work. But in SAG, there's this thing where overtime, you get like time and a half. Double time, there's a certain point where it gets to be double time, and then there's a time called golden time, and I'm not exactly sure how much, but it ends up being exponentially a lot of money for a day's work. And Fletch Lives has helped to pay for a number of expenses over the years.
So it's treated at least a meal or two for you and your wife.
Yeah, at the very least.
What was Chevy like on the set?
Work hard. He's a hard worker. I mean, when I was just looking now at some of the gags that he's doing, when he leans against the railing on the front porch in the daytime, when Becky?
Mm-hmm.
Becky drives off, I guess, and he's wearing shorts and a t-shirt, like he just ran or something, and he's got a towel around his neck, and he very casually leans against the post and falls down. And does that, basically physical comedy. And that's what he got famous for on Saturday Night Live. And he hurt his back pretty badly. He hurt himself pretty badly. He had painkiller issues for many, many years. He carefully and meticulously plans out physical comedy like that. That wasn't just, give me a rotten piece of railing and I'll fall into it. It's mm-hmm. He looks at the thing, he sets it up. All kinds of bits like, and then this one made me laugh out loud, which I'd forgotten completely. When he drives into town and he hits the parking meter and knocks it over and picks it up and puts money in it.
Yes.
Now that was genius, the picking it up and putting money in it. And and then he has the line that he can refer back to it. Yeah, I still have 5 minutes left on the meter. let's go inside and talk. And he would do, those were his ideas one after another. He kept coming up with them. He wanted to work. One of the most fun things for him seemed to be to just kind of jam. So I remember standing around at Silver Cup Studio, just the three of us standing around and just jamming. And, Michael Ritchie, the three of us, Michael Ritchie and him and I, and Ritchie would throw in something and Chevy would try something. And I decided, hell, they hired me for this role. I have no idea how to be a movie actor, so I'm just going to do what I do. And so I just kind of jammed with them and make shit up. And I'm pretty sure that the scene as originally written was substantially different than what we ended up shooting. And that was because we spent 4 or 5 hours just, you know, jamming, you know, like jazz musicians. And that's the way he seemed to behave. I never saw him treat anybody badly on a set. You know, I saw that a lot with Stallone on Lockup.
Wow.
He used to, you know, harangue people. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate. He liked me. And that's why he kept, you know, having scenes written or writing scenes for me. He seemed to be, you know, kind to everybody. You know, I heard what you guys said. Now I'm bouncing around to different topics, but I heard what you guys said about, I guess, compromised nature of Fletch's politics or its approach in terms of how nowadays it would not be considered, you know, acceptable. But the fact is, if you look at the interplay between Chevy and Cleavon Little, who is, this guy's a Tony Award winning actor who's brilliant, Blazing Saddles, mm-hmm. brilliant actor, just great actor. Chevy Chase sees through his bullshit persona in an instant.
No, you're right. And he actually says that in a voiceover.
Maybe I should have asked him to check out Calculus Enterby. I liked him, but I wasn't buying his Amos and Andy routine. He seemed a lot smarter than that.
Yeah.
And Chevy character saw right through it, right from the beginning. Why did he not run away in the Klan meeting? And so there was this understanding that Cleavon could actually say, Calculus could actually say to him, it's not a good place for a black man to be running around in the woods unless he's handcuffed to a white man. And Chevy understood that. He was from L.A. He was sophisticated. He was not racist. He was clearly a Lakers fan filled with black people. You know, well, of course, there are plenty of racists in Los Angeles who are Lakers fans, but there was this understanding. And so that's why he could joke about it with him. So it wasn't that he was saying particularly racist things and things like the Natchez Nazis with the Confederate flag and the swastika on their helmets. It would be a difficult thing to pull off in 2023. But their portrayal of these people in the South, I'm surprised that, Alabama, the song that was written, you know, that done by Leonard Skinner.
Oh,
it was mad at Neil Young because he wrote about Southern Man. That I'm surprised that more anthems weren't written about this portrayal of Southern white trash idiots in this movie, because those people were not treated kindly. You know, they were not. So, you know, it was definitely anti-racist, the movie. And I think that that's not as unacceptable as, you know, as things like, you know, just Chevy's, the sexual stuff, basically all improvised anyway, you know, what can I do to you for you, you know, lines like that. But you see, and going back to your actual question, he was great on the set. He treated everybody, with respect. That was what I saw. But like I said, I wasn't there that many days, paid for many more, but only there a few. And I just saw him as someone who worked his ass off.
The pressure was really all on his shoulders.
And the movie was what it was because of him and his work, you know, and Michael Ritchie knowing how to steer him in the direction to, you know, the good directors know how to leave an actor alone to do their best work and not try to shape them with their own vision. And he was one of those people. You know, he made some great movies. You know, I was more excited about working with Michael Ritchie than Chevy Chase. Did you ever see The Candidate with Robert Redford?
Sure. Peter Boyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing movie. Michael Ritchie directed that, and also Downhill Racer with Robert Redford. I mean,
Bad News Bears.
I mean, he was all over the map. His stuff was all over the map. Very talented guy. Harvard grad. Just like Gregory MacDonald, mm-hmm. a couple of Harvard grads.
What about Hal Holbrook? Did you have any interesting encounters with him?
Well, you know, he's a guy who comes from the theater originally. You know,
sure.
He made his bones playing Mark Twain for about 75 years.
For years. He had the one-man show. It was great.
But, you know, he was very nice. Listen, for the most part, you know, Kevin Spacey notwithstanding, most of the people who come from the theater are people that you can really feel good about. Listen, I've met Kevin Spacey a few times back in the old days in New York. because he went to school with a whole bunch of people that I worked with. And so I socialized in some of the same circles back in the late 80s. And he was, you know, a hardworking, decent guy. Just, you know, everybody sort of knew he had predilection for a certain kind of rough trade back then that they knew about. Anyway, in any case, I worked 2 days with Hal Holbrook in Universal. And he was a guy who was on time, and he knew all his words, and he was generous. You know, you always look for actors on a set who will do things like read from off camera when they're doing a close up on someone else in the scene. And not every actor does. There's a famous story about Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, in the scene in the back of the car with Rod Steiger, where when he has the famous line, could have been something, could have been a contender. Well, apparently Rod Steiger shot, not all of it, but shot some of his close-ups with Brando not there, because Brando had a psychiatrist appointment that he had to get to. And Chevy Chase was, good at doing that as well, being off camera. But Hal Holbrook, he was very, very generous in that regard.
Let him hear that bullshit chuckle, Ham.
I love that. A few years later, that movie was 89, and I got married in 93. And the year that I got married, my wife and I, we went on a, kind of a honeymoon trip to the Canadian Rockies. And then at the end of our trip, we ended up in San Diego to go see. We had been given a gift of a hotel room for a weekend. And so we finished up our honeymoon trip with a weekend in San Diego and went to see Hal Holbrook playing King Lear at the Old Globe Theater down in San Diego.
We come from the earth and we return to the earth, and in between, we garden.
Anyway, yeah, so he was nice.
Now, I had a chance to look over the Fletch Lives script this morning, and one thing I noticed is that the squeal like a pig part is not in the script. Now, is that something you and Chevy come up with off set or off camera and then do? Is it something you guys do on the spot? How did that come about?
He said... we decided, we got to figure out some way to get me down on my hands and knees. That's all he wanted to do at first. And if you watch the scene, the one that's left in, and I'm always a little pissed off every time I see this at what I did, was we rehearsed it and we decided on what to do. And in the one that the print that's there, the final cut, is me starting to go down for a second, and then coming back up and him saying,
the only way to get that out is to get as close to the floor as you can.
I was anticipating, I knew I was going to have to get down on my hands and knees. And so I started getting down on hands and my knees and realized, he hasn't told me to do that yet, so I better get back up. So that was the first thing. And then we started to do the squeal like a pig. Actually, the squeal like a pig thing is actually a funny story, because we did that. And I squealed like a pig, and we were out at Silver Cup Studios shooting that scene. But they decided, in post-production a couple months later, Jordan didn't squeal enough. We need more squealing.
You gotta be kidding.
So they brought me into a sound studio in Manhattan, where I went in. At the end of the movie, when they're in post-production, there's something that's called ADR, or additional dialogue recording.
Yes.
That we do looping, it's sometimes called, where there's some problem with the original recording, a plane, or somebody made some noise, or the final thing is wrong. So you have to come in, and you're sitting there recording words to your own mouth. You're watching on a big screen your own mouth, and you have a headset and usually one thing, one can, and they have these beeps, and it goes, beep, beep, beep. And where the fourth beep would be is when you have to start talking. And they've timed the beeps up to the what's on screen. Well, they brought me in, and I had one or two, ADR things to do, of lines of mine. But for the most part, they said, the reason we brought you in is because we want the squealing to go on longer. And so they had the movie up there, and so they're showing me, they had the footage up there. And so they're showing me the footage, and we tried it a few times, and I do it till he walks away. And I think that needs to be a little longer, they said.
sure, whatever you want, man. Because they were paying me, you know, I was done with the movie. I wasn't getting money anymore from the movie. So here's a chance to get some more money from the movie. I was unemployed at that time. Although I think I got locked up pretty soon after that. And there I was in the recording studio going, for about an hour doing that.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, they brought you back because they probably could have taken anybody.
Yeah, they could have brought Ned Beatty in or something like that.
No. They had, listen, did you hear my squeal like a pig?
That's
it's
true.
It's a very distinct squeal.
It is.
And they had me recording. And I lived in New York at the time, and this was in New York. So what did I have to do? I took a cab to a recording studio, and they paid me a day's wages.
Now that you pulled back the curtain a little bit, let's take a listen to how the final classic scene pans out.
You know, we better get that. Can't let that nest in there. They multiply by masturbation. The only way to get that out is to get as close to the floor as you can. Go on down to the floor. That's right. They're drawn to the floorboard. Now shake your head like you're trying to get the water out of your ear. That's good. But hit it no harder. No, this side. It's on this side. That's right. Now make that scream. That high pitch. That'll draw them out. Squeal like a pig. A little higher. Yay! I found a queen. I don't believe it. No one's ever found a queen. I gotta get this to the lab and get a stool sample.
I think they got their money's worth.
Yeah,
they did have some money to spend, you know,
sure.
On that movie. I was looking at that zippity-doo-dah sequence. Oh. And you know, the whole point of that is that it's, again, the same thing as the Leonard Skinner Alabama thing. It's Chevy and it's the producers and Leon Capitanis. I don't know. Actually, I don't know if Leon came up with that idea. Making fun of the South. You know, they're not glorifying anything at all in there. It's always making fun of it. But they spent some money on that.
You didn't take anything from the film, did you? Did you have any, you didn't take a prop or anything like that? Or?
Oh, yeah.
I did.
Oh.
I was thinking about going and trying to retrieve it. I have some boxes of some old stuff in my garage, amongst them a Ziploc bag that is filled with badges because I've played a lot of cops.
Uh-huh.
Right. And you're not supposed to, but I've stolen the badges from a number of those, including my Thibodeau Deputy Sheriff badge,
wow.
Which I do have.
Nice.
And it says on it, Thibodeau Deputy Sheriff, Thibodeau.
That's great.
You'll have to dig it up and send us a picture so we can post it for everybody.
I find it. I'll see if I can.
Now, I hate to pull the curtain back even further, but I can't help but notice you don't have a Southern accent.
No, I don't have a Southern accent. But, you know, also I don't have the Russian accent, but I played Russian character before, you know. And I play, you know, Cockneys. I play, you know, play guys from Brooklyn. I get hired to do accents. I have been in my career. It's music. It's like any other music. It's by ear. You know, if you could pick up the music of listening to people and mimic it. You said I did a good Sylvester Stallone impression, but, you know, he's like, shooting fish in a barrel doing an impression of him. But there are some actors that are amazing at doing impressions of other actors and quoting lines. Now, you guys are fans of this movie, so I'm not surprised that you might memorize or quote lines. But there are actors that remember they remember lines and they can do everybody. You know, I mean, I've heard guys, actors do, you know, Michael Caine and then do Christopher Walken and then do De Niro, and they're amazing and spot on. And Kevin Spacey, talking about Kevin Spacey, he's one of those guys who can do that. He can do all these guys and he does them brilliantly. You know, he's a really good impressionist. But I never did have an accent. And I started doing plays when I was 14. And I started doing Shakespeare plays when I was 15 or 16. And then I got a classical theater education at Carnegie Mellon, where we worked specifically on speech and voice. But I never wanted to sound like I was one of those actors. You know, I could do that, which is why I got cast as a lot of aliens, because they always hire classical actors, Shakespearean actors, to play aliens.
And you want to know the practical reason why?
Why is that?
The practical reason why is the teeth. Because every alien wears fake teeth. And you have to be able to speak around these teeth.
Are we talking about novelty teeth right now?
Absolutely. Those teeth, because they were for Chevy.
Yeah.
Those were expensively made. I did an episode of a Star Trek Enterprise where I played a bounty hunter. And it was a character that hadn't been around since the, I mean, a species that hadn't been around since the original series. It's like called Tellarite. And they called the Tellarite the pig people back in, it was an episode called the Babel or something like that, the Tower of Babel. And in the original series. And I was the first time they were bringing back that species.
Wait. Your pig character didn't have a high pitched squeal, did it?
Not in that one. Because you see, people called the Tellarites pig people because they had these pushed in snouts. But they, Michael Westmore, the, you know, the famous Star Trek makeup guy who did my makeup for this, he changed me. I looked more like a cross between, you know, Chewbacca and a little bit of pig thrown in. So sort of bear, wolf, dog, and pig. I was kind of a mix of all four.
Bigfoot.
Hey, I have a question about Confess Fletch. Confess Fletch came out this year with John Hamm. I was curious if you had a chance to see it yet. And I thought, with you being a fan of the books, or at least reading the books, what your thought was on the casting of John Hamm as Fletch.
I'm a fan of John Hamm's. You know, his sense of humor, his underplayed and cynical side, I think blends beautifully with, you know, Fletch and Gregor MacDonald. Because it's not the same kind of wise-ass sarcasm. It's underplayed. I mean, listen, Chevy had plenty of moments where he knew how to just, you know, barely breathe out the line. And it was not over the top. Like in another improvised line in our scene with the termite, could eat, you know, 100 times its own weight. Much like yourself, under his breath as he's walking. And that was one of about 8 different improv lines that he tried in that scene. But so he had his subtle moments as well. And I got that sense with Hal Holbrook that he had to be a little bit more serious in that scene with Hal Holbrook. You know, when he sort of gets a warning later on in the movie. And I thought, oh, Hal Holbrook influenced him to tell the truth and just look him in the eye. And, but John Hamm instinctively has a lot of the things that are made for it. You know, I guess for some reason I put it on my DVR. You know, I have AT&T Direct Stream, and I guess I must have done it at a time when Showtime was giving away a free, you know, thing. And I thought, oh, I'm going to wait. You know, I didn't have a chance to watch it. And then when I heard from you guys, and I thought, okay, maybe I'll watch it now. And I tried to watch it and said, you don't have a subscription to the service. You can't watch this. So I have to wait till I can rent it for $3.99 like I did Fletch Lives just now.
Can I ask you real quick, one of my favorite movies is Doc Hollywood. Can you talk a little bit about that? I think it's a very underrated Michael J. Fox movie because I love the book that it was based on by Dr. Neil Shulman, I think, wrote the book.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been to where it's shot there in Central Florida. It's right near Gainesville, I think it is, Micanopy or something like that.
Micanopy,
right. And I was just curious how that experience went for you.
It was one of the most fabulous experiences I've ever had as an actor for a number of reasons. The first reason was I was in L.A. I was an L.A. actor at the time. I got to audition for a woman who was considered legendary in the casting world. It was just a big year for me. I was auditioning nonstop week after week, and I did a handful of TV shows and a handful of movies and a couple of commercials and a couple of voiceovers. And it was like, oh, yeah, man, I got this thing by the tail. You know, wait a couple of years till it kicks you in the ass like it does everybody, because it does to everybody. Unless you're young and pretty, the rest of us who are not young and pretty, it's just a slog. It always has been for everybody. The second thing was I got cast. Wow, that's great. Okay, so the third thing was, hey, we're going to be based in Gainesville. It was a great place for sex and drugs and rock and roll in 1980. I got to tell you, you know, because you have all those students and all the students that stayed there.
Yeah.
Year after year, they love the place. Gainesville is a beautiful town. I mean, I don't know what it looks like now, but then there it was, 1990, 10 years later, I get to come with a movie and stay at the nicest hotel in Gainesville and get a nice convertible rental car they give me. And I'm on per diem, and I'm going to be there for like 3.5 months. And so I had a lot of free time. So I called up all the people that I was friends with when I was in Gainesville, when I was a bartender and all I had was a bicycle, to now here I am, this actor come back to town. And so that was a blast. I got to party with all of them and just be back in Gainesville and visit the theater where I had worked and hang out. And that experience was a great experience. And then the best part of it was working with Michael J. Fox, because he's probably the most generous and the kindest person I ever worked with on a set.
Wow.
You know, he was always there. He was always present, besides the fact that he's in just about every shot of the movie, but he's always there and he never acted like a star. There are three guys on the movie named Michael. Michael J. Fox, Michael Caton Jones, who directed it, and the director of photography, the cinematographer, Michael Chapman. So they all had to have nicknames since all three of them were there in basically every shot. So it was Michael Caton Jones was the Gov or Governor because he was British. Chapman was Chappie, which was a regular nickname that he had. And Michael J. Fox was, and it wasn't just the one name, it was all three. It was Jesus the Busboy. So when somebody would call for him, it was somebody's calling for Jesus the Busboy. A little racist at a time, you know, for 2023, but it was sort of acceptable, I guess, in a cringy way back then. And they were always joking, and everybody was always joking. I didn't work with Woody Harrelson or Bridget Fonda that much, but I did see them, or Julie Warner, but I did see her sometimes. I did work with her a few times during the carnival. I'm Facebook friends with her, so.
How was David Ogden Stiers? Did you work with him much?
Oh yeah, that's right, David. David, yeah, I actually hung out with David a fair amount, and we became friends after the movie in Los Angeles. He was a classically trained musician also, and he invited me to a concert where he was conducting some Mozart sonatas in Los Angeles.
When you think about Jesus the Busboy, any quick stories come to mind?
Quick story about, there's nothing quick about any of my stories, by the way, about Michael J. Fox. I was going to be in my best friend in New York's wedding. He was getting married, Michael Leahy. Rest in peace, Michael. Michael and I were the guys who discovered all the mystery and detective books together, and we would pass them on back and forth. He was a writer and a reader, but he also, you know, was a published poet, and he eventually wrote a couple of novels that were published before he died. Michael was getting married to Lynn after all the different girlfriends that I knew him dating, and I couldn't miss it. Well, it was on Saturday afternoon and Saturday night, and I was shooting on Friday, and I had to get there to be able to be there in the morning. So I had to take the red eye, and I was shooting the carnival scenes from Doc Hollywood. And there was one scene, I don't remember if it ended up in the final cut, but where I carry him on my shoulders and run down the midway with him on my shoulders.
No, I don't think that's in the movie. Yeah. I don't think that one's in the movie.
That was how I brought him to the dance floor, and he ended up dancing with the girl. And I needed to get out of there. I had like whatever it was, 11 o'clock flight out of LAX. And we were shooting up at a place called Stevenson Ranch, which is way up north of Los Angeles. I want to say like an hour away from LAX. And so I decided the only way I'm going to get out of it is to do some acting. And so this was the scene we were shooting where I was running down with Michael on my shoulders. And then there were like four scenes after that. And then the second to last scene at night was a short piece between me and him when I agreed to put him up on my shoulders and run him down there for whatever reason. And so that was going to be at the end of the night. I shoot that, then I miss the flight. There's no way I'm getting to the wedding. So we start shooting the scene where I'm on his shoulders, and it's about, I don't know, 50 feet, 75 feet that they're shooting with a steady cam, watching me carry him, and we're making noise, and the mortician, Avery or whatever his name, and the other guy, I forget who the other guy was, but all three of us numbskulls, local numbskulls, were running along with him. But I was the only one who could carry him on my shoulders. And we get down to the end and cut, and we finish, and I'm like, and I kind of put my hands on my knees and bend over like you do at the foul line when you're playing, or, you know, for a foul shot, you know, like I'm winded. And nothing, think nothing of it. Nobody says anything. And we go back to one and we do it again. And it happens again. And this time I let my knee buckle a little bit and I get back up and kind of shake my head off, whatever. I'm like, and Michael goes, "Hey man, Jordan, are you okay? What's going on?" I go, "Oh man, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. Let's shoot. Let's go again." Cause they've already called it. We're going to go again. Okay. Let's shoot. And, we do it again, and I'm like, I'm just going to sit for just a second, but I'm going to go back and do it again. And he said, "What is wrong, man?" I said, "You know, this thing has been going around in the direct. I had been sick." He said, "Are you sick, man? Or you get flu like everybody?" He said, "I don't know, man. But I'm cool. Let's do it. Let's shoot it, man. Let's muscle through." He said, okay. And then he goes over to Michael Caton Jones and the producer and talks to them and basically tells them, "Jordan is not feeling well. I want to get him out of here. So let's do this one last take, and then we'll do a quick pop of the thing that he's supposed to do at the end of the night right now. And then we'll just get him out of here." And we did that. And I got out and I got to another Michael's wedding in New York, gave a toast at the wedding, and left on Sunday and got back in time to get to work on Monday morning.
Wow.
And later on, I was in American President, and at the beginning of the production of American President, there was a reading, a table read. Rob Reiner always has, or used to then, I did six movies with him, always had a table read at the beginning of the production. And it's rare to do that with everybody in the entire movie read. And Michael J. Fox was in that movie. Mm-hmm. And so I met him, I saw him, and he came up to me, big hug, really nice, very, you know, good to see you and everything. And we're all hanging out and having lunch before we have the read. And I tell him the story about that. And he said, "I'm very proud of you." And he said, I would have been happy to help you out with that. But, you know, I'm glad that you got to your friend's wedding. I'm glad to hear that. Great. Doc Hollywood was a good movie, and it was, you know, and I don't think anybody thought it was a terrible movie. I don't remember it getting bad reviews, and it did well. And listen, Fletch Lives and Doc Hollywood and Lockup are the three movies where I continue to get the most residual payments for. They're seen all over the world still. They're all very, very popular movies.
I didn't realize till recently that Don Brockett, who plays the sheriff, was actually a regular on Mr. Rogers for almost 30 years.
Chef Brockett.
Chef Brockett.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
I'm here.
I'm all set up to show you how I make the gingerbread brockets.
Good.
I went to school in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon, mm-hmm. and KQED. KQED?
WQED. Just south of there.
Yeah, WQED. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. WQED, the station in Pittsburgh where he shot that. Mm-hmm. It's around the corner. And a lot of students from CMU used to work there regularly. A lot of wardrobe people and set construction and occasional actors. So I met him a few times in Pittsburgh. He was a kind of a fixture, a celebrity fixture in Pittsburgh, because he did some act also. I don't remember what the act was, but he did some act around Pittsburgh. But I'd actually knew of him when I got on the set, Chef Brockett. Yeah, he was.
And if you notice, he limps. He has a pretty severe limp in Fletch Lives. That's because he had polio.
Yeah, that was something that he had when he was younger, and he had a really bad hip and bad limp, and he was able to tone it down a little bit in Fletch Lives, but it was pretty pronounced before then. He was a nice guy. He was fun. He was very grateful to be in the movie and to, you know, because he didn't do a lot of movies, and to have that, you know, that nice featured role with Chevy, you know, that.
I love when he says, what's the charge? And he says, pissing me off. I love oh, yeah. I love the way he delivers that.
That was
line.
Good.
Oh, it's so great.
That was good. That was improvised. That was an improvised line, I believe. I'm pretty sure it was. You know, so much of that movie was, and so much of it was just because of Chevy's willingness to mix it up with anybody in the movie. You know, anybody who was doing scenes. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to run circles around you and you just have to try to keep up. It was, he was, you know, an equal partner in that. And because he knew, listen, his name is above the title. Mm-hmm. Another one of those lines, those great throwaway improvs that Chevy did. And your address, 7, when he's going into going into the play, you know, to watch the Jimmy Lee Farnsworth. You know, on the press tour of that, you guys had mentioned that it opened #1. You know, didn't last there very long. But in any case, on the press junket, he went on the Letterman show. He went on the Carson show. He went on Entertainment Tonight and Good Morning America and the Today Show. And in all of those shows and one or two others that I don't remember, he played the scene, the Bug Busters scene.
Now that must have been cool.
For every single one of those, that was the scene that they played. That you know, when, let's show a clip. Well, what do we need to do to set it up? And that was the clip that they kept, that they showed. So I got to, whoa, man, hey, you know. So I paid attention to that. That was a lot of fun.
The actor Josh Molina, he was a production assistant on Fletch Lives. Do you remember him at all?
Was he?
Yeah.
Was he? No, I didn't know that.
I want to play you a quick clip of an interview he did about his experience on the set of Fletch Lives. You're going to like this.
First job in film was as a PA on Fletch Lives.
Fletch Lives, that is true.
You know, he used to have aliases. He was Irwin M. Fletcher, I guess. And he, every time he gave his name, the M would be would stand for something else. And I remember he walked by once, and I undoubtedly was getting somebody coffee, because that's largely what I did as a PA. And he goes, Molina, give me a funny M name. And I went, Mahatma. Oh, I like it. And then he went out and he used it. I was like, I'm a professional writer. It's in the movie.
Wow.
That's great. That's great. You see, that's exactly the sort of thing that I would expect Chevy to do, to just like look around at people. And it doesn't matter who they are, production assistant, another actor, an extra, you know, the director, you know, let's try this or let's try that. Like I said, I wish my brain wasn't addled enough that I wish I could remember all of the things that he said in that scene. Besides the Billie Jean King, he went through, I think, 5 other names.
And that would make sense because actually in the script, it's not that at all. You ask him his name and he says, the name's Brummel.
Oh, yeah.
Bo Brummel. Bo Bob Brummel.
Yeah. Bo Bob Brummel. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, nobody thought that was funny enough, especially Chevy.
Is Multiply by Masturbation in the script?
Yes, that one's actually is in the script. That's Capitanos that wrote that.
Oh my God, that's one of my favorite lines too. I use that once in a while.
Yeah, that's another moment in the movie where I watch myself and I go, I hate watching myself because he says,
and they make this horrible high pitched noise. It's kind of like a tiny little scream. Can you hear that? Can you hear that? It's like a tiny little piglet.
And instead of getting closer, I go like this because the director said at some point you have to tip your head so he could put it in your ear. And so I'm again anticipating, just like the going down and then coming back up, I'm anticipating that because we rehearsed it, so I knew that I was going to do that and that time. But for me, the most fun part of that was when he smacked my head.
That's good, but hit it no harder. No, this side. It's on this side. That's right.
He barely touched me. That was me. That was all me.
Just the way that your whole hair flops from one side to the other. Oh, so
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, that was back at the time when I was combing my hair straight back or something and trying to fool myself. I eventually, you know, trimmed it all down or shaved it off. I scared my wife when I did that.
You may dislike the performance. It's one of our favorite scenes of all time.
No, listen, I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
We love it. You could do no wrong.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But it's just those little things that you know about yourself that you realize. But the fact that I did it the way I did it, I don't think anybody really except me is going to know that, you know.
Yeah.
But now you do.
Now, Jordan, we try to quote Fletch as much as we can. We work it into our everyday life. And I got to tell you, the line, "You smell nice," I've said to every girlfriend I've ever had multiple times.
Same.
They're clueless as to why I suddenly have a Southern accent. But the fact that they don't get it makes it even better.
Is that – that's not in the script, though, is it? That's not in the script, is it?
No.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that I improvised that. That was something that, you know, because they encourage us right from the very beginning. You know, Michael Ritchie said, we don't have a writer. You know, and I don't know if you – they knew I didn't have a lot of experience. So we're going to be making a lot of stuff up. But if you could help us out, you know, when you're in the scene, help us out. So
when Chevy gives the line, you know, "The walls are deplaning to an alarming degree," you come back with such a great response with
– deplaning?
But the way you the way you hit that line, was that an improvised line, do you think?
Yeah, that was improvised. I want to say – I'm trying to think of what wasn't improvised. I think my opening line, "Who are you?" You know, it's private property. I think that stuff was in the script. I don't remember what else was actually in the script, but I think we pretty much made everything else up.
When you come in and pull your gun, though, you mean business.
What the hell are you doing here? It's a restricted area. Didn't you see the sign?
Yeah, you're not screwing around.
Oh, yeah. I don't know nothing about no bug busters.
I didn't see no signs.
It's nice that people are still watching these. That makes me happy. Thank you very much.
You talk about people still watching them and the relevance and everything. I mean, Fletch Lives just got mentioned on Fox's Family Guy last episode, last Sunday.
Did it really? What'd they say?
I actually just got a clip of that, too. If you want to hear it, give me 1 second. All right, here it is.
But I remember my first love. It was 1989. The golden age of Hollywood. The year of Troop Beverly Hills, Fletch Lives, Gleaming the Cube, and a hilarious new addition to the Harry and the Hendersons franchise.
That's great.
That's so great. Seth MacFarlane is a huge Chevy fan and a huge Fletch fan. He's mentioned Fletch so many times.
Really?
Mm-hmm. This is the first Fletch Lives mention.
Well, Jordan, let me tell you. It has been an absolute honor to have you on the Fletchcast.
Excellent.
It's been a blast reliving Fletch Lives with you.
Thank you.
Let us know a little bit where actors who may want your coaching services or fans find you on the web.
I have several websites. I do the websites myself. I've created them. I've been teaching a film acting class here in Riverside, and my website is riversidefilmactingclass.com. And I am just starting a new class that I have a new website called riversideactingstudio.org. And they both have information about me. And then there's also jordanlund.com, which is really just about a page with some biographical and some links. And I've created a Facebook page and I've created an Instagram page, but I never do anything with them. But my wife insists that I need to do a little bit more of it, you know. But I need to work, and working means I need to get out there on social media. As I build out Facebook and Instagram, I will probably have more links.
Okay, so if fans want to get a jump on it, you can find Jordan at Jordan Lund Actor on Instagram. Like you mentioned, you can follow riversideactingstudio.org, jordanlund.com, or if you want to hire him to squeal like a pig into your voicemail, hit him up.
Thank you so much.
All right, boys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of your week. Thanks a lot.
All right, Jordan. Not for-